Welcome to Theatre Voice. I'm Alex Sears and I'm at the Lyric Hammersmith today to talk to the playwright and screenwriter Abby Morgan, whose latest play, Love Song, has just arrived at this venue in the middle of a nationwide tour. Abby is best known for her plays Tender and Tiny Dynamite, the last of which was produced by Frantic Assembly in 2001, and more recently for a string of television series and films which include Sex Traffic, The Hour, Shame, and The Iron Lady. Welcome to Theatre Voice, Abby.
Thank you very much.
Could you start off by telling us a bit about your collaboration with Frantic Assembly? When did that all begin?
I actually started working with Frantic probably about 14 years ago now. I had a strong relationship with Payne's Plough and the artistic director at the time, Vicky Featherstone, who now runs National Theatre of Scotland. And she had worked a lot with Frantic and the founders of the company, Stephen Hoggart and Scott Graham. And so I was used to working with them in the context of plays with her. And we, you know, I think initially they were very involved with a production I did of Splendor, which was a play, and they worked a little bit on the physical movement of that. And they were so inspiring. And you know, I think most good work is born out of the alchemy of people, and it was a great alchemy. I think, you know, the relationship between Vicky and Scott and I and Stephen, and so we were keen to find something else again, and so we then moved on to doing Tiny Dynamite. And you know, they're not only are they directors, but they are performers and choreographers, and so it's a very different brief writing for them. And so I've worked with them both as directors, but also as performers.
That first time with Tiny Dynamite, did you script it with some of the moves in mind, or did you just script it and then the moves were invented in rehearsal?
The moves were very much invented in rehearsal. I mean, I think what's inspiring about Frantic is that they have such a strong lyrical voice, you know, so that and that's expressed in this, you know, really beautiful physical language. So I think when I was working on it, I never really worried about how scenes would move from one to the other. I knew that they transcended the kind of typical kind of scene shifting that goes on, and so I knew that often it's the space in between scenes that are interesting with Frantic. So it's partly that, but also I feel as a play, it's a play that has constant fluid motion and movement in it. You know, it's about a sort of love triangle, but it's also about a kind of moment of explosion and kinetic, you know, sort of
and
butterfly
the whole
effect.
Idea of chance.
Of chance, and you know, absolutely, and that there are random acts, and that actually out of these random acts become, you know, moments of order and destiny. And so I think that comes very much out of the spirit of Frantic, which I think they're very spontaneous and fearless as performers.
Yeah.
And
it was a delightful production. I still remember things like a little parachute.
Yeah.
Was it a fork or something?
A fork coming down. Yeah, there was a fork, lovely things like that.
Yeah, or a strawberry coming out the...
Or a sandwich coming out of the air.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
Yeah, I mean, I was very... you know, I really loved the Darwin Awards, which were kind of crazy and mad things. You know, how can you float a man on a deck chair with, you know, 1,000 balloons? And, you know, what happens if you drop a penny from the top of the Empire State Building? But it's, you know, the fascinating thing about work is you write something, and then it's great when someone's seen the production and logged it in your mind, because it makes you want to go back and read the work again, you know.
Yeah.
So you probably know that play better than I do now.
I doubt it, but okay. Let's talk about Love Song then. How come you came back to working with...
I always wanted to work with the boys, as I call them again. But, you know, I think we both, you know, they've been incredibly busy over the years with production. Also, I write less and less theatre as life has gone on, and so it takes quite a lot to learn back to theatre, because I find it a very difficult medium actually to write for, and I think I felt more confident knowing that I would be working with them, because I think what's great about Frantic is that they are makers of work, you know.
Yeah.
And so I knew that they would accept a more sort of poetic half-formed play in a way, and that the play would be made in rehearsal. So we just waited and waited and waited, and partly it was to do with the idea, you know, but also with money, you know, primarily to do with time.
How do you mean it was to do with the idea?
Well, finding an idea that both captivated,
us.
Yeah. So it was, you know, and it started with Scott saying, you know, I'd love to do something. He liked, you know, T.S. Eliot's poetry, and also, you know, Love Song of Proof Rock. And so that was very, that was quite an inspirational starting point. And I was quite intrigued by the notion of, the longevity of marriage and how one survives the kind of domestic boredom, domestic metronome, kind of domestic brilliance of a married life. And so I think that, you know, I think those are themes that probably strike us all now in a different way to when they did 10 years ago, because obviously we're now all entering our 40s or in our 40s, very much in our 40s if you're in my case. And so I think the themes that we were interested in have changed.
And I read in an interview, I don't know if this is right, but that also your father died, so you got to thinking about death, and Love Song is partly about death too.
Yeah, very much
it?
So. I think when you reach your 40s, then we probably are hitting a point where our, our parents do start to, age, or, I think you become more aware of your place in the grand scheme. So, I have two children, so suddenly I have a generation coming up behind me, quite literally, but, in my head I'm still 20, and then I look at my babysitters coming, and they're beautiful girls at 20, and I think, I'm like a grandma to you. So, there is a whole generation that I think have been invisible to me, and so it's partly seeing yourself in a kind of circle of life, but I think also my father died 3 years ago, and it's a profound moment. I wasn't, I had quite a complex relationship with him, but it was a very profound moment watching, someone die. And also, I'm not religious, so for me I didn't necessarily have a sort of sense of an afterlife, and so the kind of complete circle of it felt much more apparent to me.
Yeah, and there's no sense of consolation, there's no hope of sort of, in your mind, I suppose, or perhaps...
No, but I don't see that as a negative. I think that's rather wonderful, actually. I think it's rather wonderful that we come onto the planet and we're here for however long we are, and hopefully we burn bright and we affect change and we love and, we are loved. And so I think that's enough in life. I don't need the aftermath, really. That's enough for me. And I, in a way, I think that's a legacy I want to pass on to my children, because I feel then it's about living in the moment. And, and also I'm very pro the right to die. And so actually I think it's a very important play for me, because I think that it's very simplest. I think it's a play that says one has a right to choose, And I think we put it in religious Christian context, death. And actually I think if we take it out of that context, then I think it's, it's a very human an active role to take. We make choices about how we come into the world, so why don't we make choices about how we go out in the world? So that's why I feel it's an important play.
In Love Song, could you give a sort of brief plot summary? I know it's a sort of silly thing, but it's quite easy in this case, really.
It's really simple. I think there are theatrical devices which I wouldn't necessarily give to every director, but I think the nature of Stephen and Scott's work and the Frantic Assembly's work is that I knew that they would be able to handle the concept of a couple on stage at two very different points in their lives. So effectively we have the couple as two married young married people.
And you've called them William and Margaret.
William and Margaret,
in a kind
and then
of rather
yeah.
old fashioned way.
Yeah, in a sort of 50, so we're seeing William and Margaret probably kind of from early 60s until late 70s period, and then we see Maggie and
Billy
sort of entering more kind of in their 70s really, and really what we're actually witnessing is a couple who are facing the last week of their lives together, and it sort of seeps through the play that you realise that actually these couple are actually making a choice about how this ending is going to take place, and the kind of pain and the terror and the the challenges that brings leads them to go back into their memories and their past and sort of place themselves in the context of their lives and how they got there.
Yeah, so you see a bit about their lives. For example, I think they've moved to the United States, is that right?
Yeah.
And that William or Bill becomes a dentist, and there are several of these kind of leaps in the dark, because he doesn't know if he'll make it and so on. And then you show also that kind of middle-aged, let's call it midlife crisis, when both of them consider having an affair and so on. Well, why did you choose that? Because that sort of calls their marriage quite radically into question.
I think we probably leave them in their early 40s, which is where I'm at. So I kind of wrote up to what I felt I knew and an imagined world of what I felt I had observed in an older marriage. So, maybe the next play will enter the 50s, 60s, I know. So it's partly that. I think it's... I was kind of intrigued about the moments that define us, the moments where it will be so easily to easy to separate. I think the tribute to Prufrock is that, we measure our lives in coffee spoons, and I think it's, you know, I think what often links us and unites us are those tiny domestic rituals, which actually look like nothing, but are sort of touchstones in our lives that connect each other every day. So they're the sharing of a cup of coffee, they're the sharing of memory, they're the sharing of friends, they're the sharing of a house. And so, and I think when you see it from the older couple's perspective, you see that this has now settled into something that is treasured. And I think what's interesting is that, you know, I mean, I've been in a relationship for 11 years now and I have two children, and I think I recognise very clearly the point where I think, well, hopefully I'll be in this forever, but who knows? I like the moment of capturing the moment of decision where you kind of went, I'm ready to commit this to this. And this can often be after you've had children. What's interesting about our couple is that they don't have children, and I think that also taps into the notion of what is one's legacy if you don't have children, and what do you leave behind you. And I hope it's about the bigger imprint, emotional. Yeah.
I mean, physical. You find an elegant solution to that by having them hand on their belongings to the son of the next door neighbour, and so, which was very beautiful, I thought. But also, you have radically simplified their life, partly by moving them to another continent, which, you know, usually, I mean, your play is about the fact, I think, that we come into the world on our own. I think you've said this in another interview. And we usually leave it in the company of other people, either of our children or our partner or something like that. And here you've simplified it. Was it just to make it easier to deal with, you know, 90 minutes of a whole life and a whole marriage, or...?
I think, I found one of the most interesting things about having children was that my identity as a couple changed, and that suddenly we were a unit, and that was very... And I felt that, you know, I have a very close relationship with my mother and my siblings, and I love them dearly, and they're very much in my lives, but ultimately, when it really comes down to it, it's about me and my husband and my children, and so... I liked the kind of simplicity of that. You know, when I die, I will probably be with my husband, you know. I think they, you know, there was a reference to parents in the play. So partly that's also partly when I was writing it, I just found myself thinking this couple don't feel like they're in the UK. I couldn't find the location for me of where they were going to be. And I liked the landscape of them being displaced. I felt they were in a displaced, emotionally they were in a displaced situation. And so... I felt that there was something of, there was a sort of immigrant quality to it. I like the idea of migration. You know, there's a sort of feeling about, you know, the kind of circle of the year. You know, they talk about peaches being picked, they talk about it's getting colder, they talk about starlings.
And they're also slightly alienated from their friends and neighbours in that they have a different sort of ethic and a different work.
I think there are moments, and I think there are moments in all our lives where we are in the same club as our friends, and then there are moments where we move away. So I just know in my own life, you know, I've a number of friends who haven't chosen to have children. I think it's been periods where, you know, I'm sure they've gone down one path and I've gone down another. But what's interesting is you come back together again when you find your children are older and, you know, you have more time, you reconnect and you realise actually, you know, we go in and out of each other, one another's lives. But also it's intriguing to me that, you know, I did have children, but I have a number of friends who haven't. And I think one finds one's way of being parents in different ways when you don't have children.
I saw The Iron Lady last night, and what struck me a week after seeing Love Song is...
There's a real connection, isn't there?
Yeah, two portraits of old people that are very, very deep and well thought out. Were you writing at a similar time?
I had actually written Iron Lady before, but I think that the fracturing of memory is definitely related structurally. But you know, the fracturing of time has always been something I've been interested in. If you look at a play like Splendor, and it's something that, you know, and I've written a number of screenplays actually that all, you know, I've written one very recently that goes into production this year, and I think that also plays with time and memory. So, you know, I'm very intrigued by the notion of how we, what actually happened and how we perceive it or mythologize it. So those are definitely things that I'm interested in, but also I'm aware, you know, I'm 43 now, and I'm aware that my own memory is already, you know, experiencing a weird flickerboard. So, you know, I bumped into someone very recently, and we welcomed each other, embraced, and said, how wonderful to see you again, I haven't seen you for ages. And I knew that this person had been significant to me. I knew that we probably spent several fun evenings together somewhere in my 20s, but I couldn't really define where. And that was really surprising to me, and I thought, God... you know, some moments burn bright when you can remember what you ate that day, yeah. but you actually can't remember who the company you were in.
Yeah,
and I think, and so notions of memory, and also I have a real humility about aging now. You know, I do feel like there was a generation when I was in my 20s that I just wrote off as old. I didn't even notice. And now when I see the most elderly person, I think that's me.
Yeah. Well, in the 60s, we used to sing Hope I Die Before I Get Old with The Who. And now, no thank you.
Absolutely.
Put that one on hold. It's interesting also for me, because the Iron Lady had an on-stage ghost, if you like. Mm. And so that also seems to feed into Love Song, with these two couples constantly occupying the stage together and so on, and interacting as memory and so on. And was that there, your conception from the beginning, to have the two young and old couple touching,
dancing? I was really fascinated by that, and I liked the idea. You know, I wanted to slightly confront. One of the things that's great about working for Frantic is they have this incredibly young audience, and I felt the thing I wanted to express, you know, it's the Oscar Wilde quote, you know, youth is wasted on the young. I wanted to write a play where a 16-year-old would go, God, I want to go out tomorrow and live my life now, because one day I will get old. But also to go to recognise older people as living sexual beings, you know, as well. Because I think that's the other thing, is that I'm going in that direction. I don't want to be put in that other invisible place.
Exactly. Could you say a bit about some of the images? Because obviously what's striking is that there's the image of teeth, there's the image of starlings, the birds, and the caves in France, those prehistoric paintings.
Well, actually, you know, Frantic are very inspired by music. And at the time when I started writing this, Elbow had written Seldom's Seen Kid, which is a beautiful album. And one of the key songs on that are Starlings. And and we were very infected by their music and inspired by their music. So I think I just think... I just love what they do, and I love the lyrics. It's just poetry for me, their music. So that was very much a kind of soundscape for me when I was writing it. So I think some of the images have come from their work. I think that I knew that the visual style is always beautiful, and you know they break boundaries a little bit, Frantic, and so I liked the fact that actually. I mean, I had no idea they were going to do the video installation, and I love that now, and I had no idea that was coming, but I think they're quite unadulterated about taking images and using them in a very bold way. The notion of the caves are really fascinating. You can't actually touch those caves anymore.
But my idea is you could,
when they go there, it's the 50s and the 60s, and they could then, so I did my research. And so I like the idea of something that they'd experienced, something that you couldn't do anymore. So there was partly that. And I liked the fact that I did feel, you know, I felt, you know, watching my father die was so fascinating, because he was so absolutely mentally present right the way to the end, and yet he was such in a state of decline that you realise that the life force stays, and it makes you think about 21 grams and where do our souls go, and our souls do extinguish, I think, and yet there is this indefinable spirit in us, and so... the notion of ghosts were very interesting, because I feel like the ghosts are actually about the spirit of their present that we perhaps carry with us. So ghosts are always fascinating to me.
And the idea of those caves holding those kind of memories as well.
Yeah, and also being so deep in the earth.
Oh, yeah, the idea also psychologically subterranean.
Burying yourself. You know, another adaptation I've done this year is Birdsong.
Oh, yes.
So I spent a lot of time in the trenches and looking at tunnel, you know, going down tunnels, and the notion of being buried alive and one's mortality in the construct of war and... the fragility of life. So, you know, those themes are very vivid.
Yeah, and there's a climax to this play when all four of them are on the bed, and there's this. It's just preceded by this image of the cave once again, repeated again. What for you was the meaning of the four of them on that bed in that really? To me, it seems incredibly exalted, but I did wonder what did it kind of mean.
Yeah, I mean. That was about connecting with the sex. For me, it's quite sexual. That, I mean, it's about the kind of hallucinate. I mean, the literal is a woman is lying in bed with her husband. She's in the last week of her life. She's hallucinating. She's, you know, Her brain is sort of hotwired by drugs, and so the flickerboard of memory is sort of coming alive. I think the physical visual for me was, I was kind of fascinated about hurling two couples together in a sort of weird dreamlike moment, so that suddenly the younger man would be with the older woman, and the older, and actually, you know, when you look at someone you love, they look exactly as the way they used to. And they, you know, they don't actually change.
Yeah.
But actually, if you look at photos of yourself, you can see clearly that you've aged with someone all the time.
And so
it's something beyond the physical that connects us. And so I wanted to kind of... there's something quite provocative about bringing those two moments together for me.
And also it was... dancing, but not really dancing.
No.
Isn't it? They are,
I think,
lying.
Also the physicality of working with older actors is interesting.
Yes.
You know, you've got. I mean, having said that, you know, Sean Phillips can do more push-ups than anyone else in that company. It should
be more than me. I can tell you that.
I mean, she's absolutely amazing, and physically, my God, I would die to have a pair of legs like hers. But I think there's something uncomfortable about seeing an older woman with a younger man, or an older man with a younger woman, or. And inherently you're looking at actors who are working at a slightly different pace and energy to the younger actors, and so they're bringing a different quality to the work, and I like those two qualities coming together.
Right. I'm afraid we've run out of time. Thank you very much.
No, that's fine. Nice meeting you.